Backyard Green Films is proud to present this episode of Agriculture with your host, Alara Bowman. Alara and her husband, Rick, travel throughout the land in their travel trailer, which they have nicknamed Bessie, bringing you stories about their travels and the people they meet. They visit farmers, ranchers, and just about anyone who loves putting their hands in the dirt or their feet in stirrups. In those travels, they have gotten to meet some very interesting people. Here's one of those interviews.
Hi, this is Alara. Welcome back to our podcast. We had such a good time at the National Western Stock Show in Denver that we decided to podcast twice this month with bison content in honor of one of the most awe-inspiring animals we've ever seen. There's still a wildness to them, and from the moment you set eyes on them, they evoke an emotional response. For some of us, it's a bit of a prey response if the bars between you and it are not quite as solid as you would hope. The corrals in Denver were just made for this reason, though, so we felt safe enough to get up close and personal. Anyway, we're making February our honorary bison month here on the podcast. Awe-inspiring they are, though. I keep thinking about those moments I stood on the 25-degree snow-covered grounds of the event center and gazed through the corral bars at the mass of mammal, otherwise known as the American bison, or the American buffalo. After we got home, I started down the rabbit hole of research to find out more, and we've included some links for you in the written intro to sites like the Smithsonian's National Zoo and Conservation Biology Institute, the National Bison Association, and good old Wikipedia. If you rummage through the reference links at the bottom, you can sometimes get some really interesting links to technical papers from that site. We also popped in links to one of my favorite sites called explore.org, where their live webcams up there bring nature up close and personal in both sight and sound. The bison watering hole in Saskatchewan, Canada is looking pretty chilly this week, let me tell you. I found out that there are two subspecies of this mammal in North America. The one we most commonly hear about is the plains bison, which, believe it or not, is the smaller of the two. It's the one we usually think about in all those Western flicks running in endless waves over the plains. Okay, maybe not endless, but there were supposedly over 60 million of these guys in the late 1700s. Between hunting and slaughter and introduced pathogens, we managed to quickly bring the population down to under 600 by 1889. Yes, I did say under 600. That's not a good interesting fact, is it? But they're working on the numbers and things have gotten better. And as you'll hear about today, these babies have to be commercially viable or they're going to go the way of the dodo. Sometimes it's a serious bummer to be a migratory mammal in a world of fences and strip malls. But it's a good thing to give the animal a purpose so they can continue to exist. And yes, everybody, that does mean eating them. It's good in the long run, and it's pretty darn healthy food, too. I've included links to the National Bison Association's website so you can learn about this animal's role in regenerative agriculture and easily find some producers near you. The nutritional profile on their site says that bison stacks up really well when compared to other sources of protein. When you compare it to beef, it has 26% more iron, 87% less fat, and roughly half the calories. When you compare it to chicken, it's 8% lower in cholesterol, 32% lower in fat, and has 766% more vitamin B12 with also fewer calories. I hear that the key to cooking this is apparently low and slow, or that reduction of fat is going to make it tough if you cook it like other meat. Okay, back to the North American subspecies. The second type of this animal on this continent is the second or third largest living bovid in the world, and the 12th largest land mammal in the world, depending on who you ask. This is the wood bison or wood buffalo, also called the mountain bison or mountain buffalo, and it's even bigger than the ones you might see at Ted Turner's ranches. From its name, you might guess that it's often found in the boreal forest areas, and your best bet to see these guys is up in Canada or somewhere close to that. Large males can reach over 2,600 pounds. The plains and the wood varieties are the only two in the bison clan left standing in North America, though they do have some relatives across the pond. Now, I don't know if you're like me in this, but I still struggle with the usage of the term bison versus buffalo, because I'm an Oxford comma kind of girl. So I did a little bit of reading up on the most accepted common names of these creatures. For the record, the ones we see at the National Western are known by the scientific name of Bovidae bovinae bovina bison. And please forgive my Latin pronunciation. If you ask a technocrat, again, that's usually me, a buffalo this animal is not. I think I'm going to take the easy route and blame the French trappers and Samuel de Champlain for the slide into the term buffalo on that one. Either way, it's the fault of the French, she said with a smile. Smithsonian's National Zoo and Conservation Biology Institute says that buffalo and bison are distinctly different, and the true buffalo are from Africa and Asia, while bison are from Europe or North America. Both family Bovidae, but definitely not the same in ways other than location. Bison. Bison. Keep saying that to yourself, Alara. It's the official national mammal of the United States, so that might be a good thing for me to remember if I ever get invited to a cocktail party at the Smithsonian. That said, common usage over the last few hundred years as buffalo has made it very acceptable to call it either name in most circles. As we learned a few weeks ago in our interview with Chad Kramer, the herd manager at Custer State Park, these animals aren't just the things that keep the tourist population under control at Yellowstone. They are livestock now. Pretty damn wild and woolly livestock, but just the same, it's an old and yet new frontier in agriculture in some places. And consumers are finally catching up. Even when we do catch up, it's hard not to see this animal as something very wild. That feeling exists when you're separated by the sturdy steel bars of a corral at the event center grounds. But it's particularly acute when you're daydreaming along a wooden walkway at Yellowstone National Park and you come around the corner face to face with a 6-foot-tall, 1-ton bull busily scratching on a post until you interrupted him. By the way, when you enter Yellowstone, the park system hands out those little Dayglo flyers upon entry, upon which are written in all caps something like, "Stay away from the bison. They can reach speeds of 35 miles per hour, which is 3 times faster than you can run." People are injured and killed each year by these things. Idiot people who ignore the Dayglo, mind you, but still, the beasts are not to be trifled with. Rick and I had another meet and greet with these animals when we stayed at South Dakota's Badlands National Park a few years back. The back campground is lovely and remote, and it has nice bathrooms, but I didn't visit the facilities very often because they just happened to be in the middle of an area where the bison like to hang. Mind you, there were these big critters everywhere, but they really seemed to like to come over and rub themselves on the signpost on that particular spot. The next closest restrooms were 15 miles down a very bumpy dirt road, so this particular camping trip was as close as I've come to relieving myself in a crowd since I was a baby. And that might have actually happened if the herd hadn't moved along. Needless to say, we only stayed one night, nice as it was. On to the second half of a bicentennial. Buffapalooza? Okay, Bison Month. Today's interview was with Jim Matheson, the executive director of the National Bison Association. We grabbed him for a few minutes of conversation in the midst of a Sunday loadout, which was pretty interesting. If you go to our YouTube channel and our new episode of Vicarious Agriculture with Chad Kramer, you can see these babies up close and personal. And a snippet from the loadouts in there too, in case you've ever wondered how to get North America's largest land animal to go from a comfortable corral into a big metal moving box. I know, very carefully, right? Jim is more on the marketing side of things in bison land. If you can go down to your local store and buy a bison burger, it's due to guys like this. And you couldn't do that quite so easily 20 years ago, could you? By the way, there is an official bison month that's celebrated here in the U.S., July. But since it's 90-plus degrees in many parts of the Dakotas in high summer, well, beautiful grassy plains or not, we are sticking with February. Just a quick warning to all of you who haven't been to a stockyard when everybody goes back on the trailers, otherwise known as the loadout. It is loud. Hopefully in this case, listening makes you feel more like you were there. And no, I'm not going to start singing Jackson Brown. You can all be thankful. Here's Jim. Hi, would you introduce yourself, please?
Yes, I'm Jim Matheson. I'm the executive director of the National Bison Association.
Okay, now, we just sort of jumped on you out here in the yards here. We're in the bison yards at the National Western.
That's right.
Yeah, so tell me what you're doing here, both as an individual and maybe as an organization.
Absolutely. So our organization, the National Bison Association, we are based here in Colorado. And we have been having this bison sale for 43 years now. 43 years. Yeah, we started here, and a couple years back, because of COVID, we had to go to Rapid City, South Dakota for our sale. But otherwise, we usually have about 100 bison come in every year for National Western Stock Show, and we have the gold trophy show and sale. The animals are judged and then sold at auction. And yeah, it's been a wonderful event over the years.
Yeah, now the National Western, I had always associated with cattle and other animals like that. And and yet, all of a sudden this year, I'm seeing bison, and last year, and I said, oh, well, it's just the last couple of years. But you said to me, no, this has been going on here for a while. How
that's
long?
Right. Yeah, 43 years we've been here. So
at the show, not just, that's amazing that there's not quite so much coverage on that, and it's not quite so obvious. You're out here obviously in the hinterlands, I would say.
Yep. So these are the new stockyards, of course, the National Western Stock Show. They're redeveloping the whole complex, as you know.
Yep. And I'm going to hold on just one second. We absolutely got that tractor going behind us. This is a beautiful thing. So, okay, there we go.
So, yeah, they've been working on redeveloping the National Western Stock Show for a couple years, and they've been kind enough to build us bison-specific pens. So you'll notice the signage here, the Del Hensel Bison Facility. And Del Hensel was a pioneer in our industry who passed away a little while back, and we wanted to memorialize him here. So this is a wonderful facility that we were able to build, mostly to our specs, to handle bison, which the largest mammal in North America takes a little bit more than your usual cattle, swine, et cetera, to handle them.
But is that just a question of it needs a taller fence or something, or is that strength as well?
Well, not only, yes, strength certainly and height of the pens, et cetera, but also keeping the gates quiet, for example. So we use silicone on the gates, and that's because these animals were never domesticated. So these are essentially wild ruminants that we're stewarding. And as such, they're very prone to stress. So loud bangs, hooting and hollering, that is not a good fit for handling bison. So we want it as quiet and calm as possible, which really equates to low stress handling, which is good for the animal and is what consumers want at the end of the day.
That also means to me that this is a big day for you guys because you're loading and unloading and you're getting ready to go out. Everybody said, the bison, when they get out, they go.
They go.
They really head out.
Yep, so this 94 head that we sold yesterday at auction, they are going across the country into breeding programs. So we're diversifying genetics, bringing on new sires, et cetera, which people purchased yesterday to introduce into their herds. And then they'll hopefully bring back their offspring to sell here in future years.
Now, that's one thing we were talking about yesterday. You're diversifying your genetics in an animal that really had just free reign to breed in whatever way it chose and let nature choose the sires.
That's right.
And until, obviously, we're treating this as a livestock animal instead of a wild animal, even though it is both.
Yes.
And when it hits the news, it's usually, you know, some idiot tourist ran and stuck their kid on the bison, right?
Right.
But these are wild animals, and
absolutely.
So when we manage them from an agricultural perspective, as a product, and we do selective breeding, how does that change them, if at all?
You know, it's interesting. It's a great question, and I think what we have going for us is that, again, going back to their undomesticated nature, we do not artificially inseminate. So it will not work on a bison. There has been some success in AI in conservation herds and that sort of thing in more of a lab setting. However, on the ranch, we do not artificially inseminate, and that's because due to the stress, again, it typically doesn't take. And we do not want to industrialize this animal or this industry. So we are trying to keep things as natural as possible and utilize their natural instincts to our advantage. So along with the AI and selective breeding, we're selecting for specific traits and what people like. It could be color, it could be size, different elements of conformation, basically, that our producers are looking for to add to their herd. But what happens when you artificially inseminate is you really take those traits down to a handful. So if you look at the dairy industry, for example, most of those animals can get traced back to a half a dozen sires anymore, you know, whereas we don't want to go down that path.
Yeah.
And I think it does result in much more diverse genetics in the North American bison herd.
Yeah, we didn't get to talk about this earlier with you, but that's how we got involved in this whole thing. We did a film called The Holstein Dilemma.
Okay.
And we are not anti-Holstein at all.
We are not either.
And yet, because we do need to feed the planet.
Yep.
And so we do need to maximize production. And yet, this is
this has caused a real issue in our production systems, that we are just selecting for certain traits, and so you got a bunch of animals, but a very small genetic pool,
exactly.
And it can get dangerous.
Yep, absolutely.
So I think it's just something that we all need to think about. It's not necessarily good, bad, or the other. It's good in many ways.
No, absolutely, and we are full support of all of our beef.
Yeah.
Neighbors and friends that do the best job of being beef in the world.
Yep.
And we want to be the best at doing bison in the world.
Yep.
Right?
Yep, very definitely. Okay, so it's also very interesting to me that when you you want to do artificial insemination to make your life easy, but the hardest animals to transport are also the ones that may not take so well, because I know we spoke to a couple of people in the draft horse industry, and they said, you know what, it is not... We do not have the success rate. We're at 40% to 60% with certain breeds of draft.
Mm-hmm.
And yet that's the one that you really want to, because this is not an easy animal to transport. So it's much easier to transport that little vial than it is to transport the animal itself.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, absolutely.
So I mean, I'm looking at the... looking at these very loud and yet very necessary trailers here.
Yep.
They're big.
Yes.
I mean, they are really, really big. So when you transport a bull, I'm assuming you transport the bull or you transport the cows?
No, we transport everything.
Okay, and we'll say, it is cow?
Yes.
Correct? Is
it's
that the correct
bull,
terminology?
A heifer and a cow, yeah.
Okay, just so like, people who, it is definitely...
It's a bovine.
It's a bovine, yep. So you transport whatever animal to the sire or the sire to the animal?
Well, there's different operations, different models out there. You know, some people do run single sire herds. A bull will serve up to a dozen or so females. Male to female ratios are important because you know, if you have too many bulls in there, they will fight for dominance, for breeding rights, of course, you know, and that can result in losses and injuries, etc.
Yeah.
So that has to be managed carefully.
Yeah.
Other operations take a more natural approach, I suppose, where they do let the bulls sort it out among themselves.
Yeah.
But in a well-managed herd, you know, our conception rates are very good, typically 90% plus.
Yeah, good for them.
This is with this approach of not artificially inseminating, as we say, relying on romance in the pasture. And as such, since we haven't tinkered with this animal or its genetics, you know, the result is that bison still act and behave and look like they did 150 years ago, which is, again, what we're looking to do is utilize those instincts that they've retained to our advantage as farmers and ranchers.
Yeah.
So,
but that can be a little rough too, because I mean, it's rough love, right? It's, but when you look at these animals, they are not, I'm not going to say gentle, but you know, you definitely have to, you've taken the siding on here and you have this green screen.
Yep.
I guess maybe explain that, because
when
they get really going, they are big animals and you can hear them banging around back there.
They are extremely quick, agile, can turn on a dime, no problem. So yes, what we do with the screens, for example, so along the pens, you know, we're trying to block out the light, essentially, and they will run towards the light. So that is how we, the handlers here, move these animals about, and they're just trying to escape, essentially, right? It's fight or flight. So we try to manage accordingly.
So you have those green screens you might see on the edge of the golf courses that prevent the animals from seeing all the people out there, too. I would assume that makes it a little easier.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yep, absolutely.
Yeah, it's interesting. You got the Temple Grandin Center over here, and she was really big in the slaughter facilities with talking about how the path on the way into slaughter, they need to not be able to see where they're going so much, so they are more easily handled and they're not so panicky.
Exactly.
And
we've worked with Dr. Grandin for years and years. She spoke at many of our conferences. We're just down the road, of course, from Colorado State University.
Yes.
And she's been a great friend of the industry. She's also advised a lot of our slaughter facilities on how to do a better job of humanely treating those animals.
Yeah, that's fantastic. So I'm going to go back for a second to when you transport and you have to do breeding.
Yes.
And so it is not a gentle thing, and there's a danger also that the animals can be injured. So there's a danger when you transport them in a vehicle like this one that's heading out right now.
Yep.
And then when you get to the spot where you need to do the breeding, and then when you load them up again.
So we don't move animals so much for breeding specifically. You know, we run our animals on one pasture year round. And we rarely bring in bulls and take them out just for producing. You know, these are folks that are just adding new genetics to the herd, and they'll stay there typically until they decide to sell them and add some more genetics to them. And that can take a while. These are very long-lived animals, very long productive life. You know, the bulls can work up to 10 years or so. We have producers that have had cows that are 30 years old that still have a calf every year.
Okay, so that's like the Longhorn people. They say 9 months and 15 minutes after the last calf,
they have
another one.
Right.
And they really keep going. And the cows, they've got 20-year-old cows that are still popping them out every single year.
Right.
So this is something about the nature of the animal that has evolved in rough territory and on their own for so long that really adds to there's a production model that says, you know, I want that. Even if it doesn't produce the same quantity of meat or the same, the volume of the animal, it requires less maintenance, and boy, it just keeps going. I know that the Holsteins are having a little bit of issue now with it at times with their genetics because they've selected for milk for so long, milk production, that the fertility part kind of drops out a little bit.
Yep.
And you can inject more in there, but then you're saying, okay, is it related to the other Holsteins? So it's interesting that bison and longhorn are kind of in that category, that they're on their own long enough to where they still really, fertility is a really great trait that they
have. Absolutely, yes. Yeah. And they are proven survivors. You know, we were down to less than 1,000 bison left in the world at just 150 years ago.
Really?
Yep, and very hardy animals. So the other thing that we're seeing is that more and more producers are raising the animals, not only for the great market that we've developed for the meat, but because they're survivors, very hardy animals. And as the weather changes and we get more intense storms and that sort of thing, there's a whole lot less death loss with bison in these big blizzards than there are cattle, for example.
You gave me a great segue there, because I wanted to talk about the marketing. Now, you have a ranch, and we talked about Ted Turner a little bit, who is probably one of the most well-known people, I would say, to the general populace.
Sure.
Because he, both of the corridors that he was trying to develop as the bison, but also he's got the restaurants, and he says, look, I think this is a great animal to market. So tell me a little bit, first of all, your ranch and the name of your ranch, if you have one.
Sure.
Correct? And then also how marketing has changed over time, and the development of that.
Absolutely. So I don't have a ranch personally. I live in the Denver metro area here, so not quite enough space for a bison. I have had absentee owner animals on other operations and that sort of thing. So I don't have any right now, but I'm looking to get back into it here. So as executive director of the National Bison Association, my full-time job is the association and our work here, which does include marketing.
And that is a full-time
great
job.
Screen.
All
that's
that right
a full-time
there.
Job in itself, exactly. So, no, you know, we started promoting bison meat about 20 years ago, as it should be, which is an American delicacy that is raised extremely naturally, resulting in very clean meat. It's the most lean protein really available today in the marketplace. It's leaner than skinless chicken, for example, with an incredible nutrient profile that has all the good vitamins that we want, great mineral content, etc. And so we started promoting that, and, you know, it's really caught on in the natural food sector. So folks looking for, again, clean meat, raised very humanely. And the added bonus is that as consumers are purchasing and eating bison, they're helping to restore the herd, right? So we are still very much in recovery from those less than 1,000 head 150 years ago. We're up to about 500,000 head today across North America.
Now, that's one of the things that we did some work with the Livestock Conservancy, and one of their big taglines was, in order to save some of these animals, you need to eat them. And that's a really important component, because otherwise there's no market, right?
Exactly.
You just have a pet.
No, in fact, we've got a campaign right now, Eat Bison to Restore Bison. Yeah. And it's a very simple equation in that, again, as folks consume bison, that is creating economic incentives for landowners to put bison on their properties, thereby restoring the species as a whole. And it's not just ranching. It's also, we work very closely with conservation efforts of bison, as well as tribal restoration of bison. So it's this very unique sector of agriculture where, you know, we want to work with conservationists. We want to work with tribal members because we're all in it for the same thing at the end of the day, and it's to save this animal.
So how, I've seen bison in the herds in places like Yellowstone and the Dakotas.
Sure.
And they are big animals, and when they wallow, they really wallow. But how do they fit into a conservation? I mean, are they hard on the pasture, or is it just a question of volume?
Well, it is. There's a lot of variables there, of course. So it is volume, and it depends on the management, too. So, you know, you mentioned wallowing, for example. When a bison wallows, which it does naturally, that is creating a divot in the earth where water is going to collect, thereby providing water sources for other animals, birds in particular. And it's really amazing. You know, we see folks that bring bison onto properties, and within 6 months, you know, they've got new native grasses coming back up. They've got a lot of new wildlife coming onto the property. And it's all going back to everything working in concert, right, which is how the prairies were developed.
Yeah, and they're definitely migratory grazers, correct? I mean, they're going to try and cover every scrap of pasture they possibly can.
Yes, they do, and they're real good like that. It's funny, we see a lot of trends in the cattle industry, mob grazing, rotational grazing, etc. And in our opinion, that's largely based on natural basin grazing behavior, you know. And with that, we manage our animals accordingly. Rotational grazing is quite popular with bison, but we don't need such small paddocks because they'll rotate on their own, right? So as they did historically and migrated across most of North America.
Okay, so with such small numbers, how do you transport genetics? How do you bring genetics together in a way that conserves without narrowing that pool so much? Because that's like needs a spreadsheet at some point,
that's
right?
Right?
I mean, that's a complex complication.
Definitely. No, and stewardship is a big part of the puzzle here. So, in all of our educational materials at the National Bison Association, we really promote keeping those genetics diverse, bringing in new bulls from time to time to avoid inbreeding, and et cetera. And as such, you know, we really do have quite a diverse gene pool today, thanks to shows like this, the Gold Trophy Show and Sale, and there's, you know, about 20 other auctions across the country where folks are doing the exact same thing.
Yeah, so I know that there are quite a few people out there, and I'm one of those that believes in the power of science. I mean, science is an incredibly powerful thing.
Absolutely.
And I know in agriculture we've had a tendency to say, oh, we can fix it by, you know, we'll just use CRISPR technology or whatever it happens to be to solve all the problems that we have with both the narrowing of the gene pool and, you know, the production model. Maybe we just kind of tweak the Holstein genetics just a little bit to get fertility back.
Sure.
Is it at some point, though, do we take a lesson from the bison and say science does not do everything because AI is not necessarily going to take with everything, or it
Absolutely.
May not solve all of our problems?
No, and we very much support science as well. In fact, we established the Center of Excellence for Bison Studies just 2 years ago at South Dakota State University. And the center is really the hub of all research and data. There's one of those bison trailers. All the research and data that's being done, and there's a lot going on right now in bison research, which is wonderful. But no, and we utilize science as well. You know, we DNA test our animals. That's pretty common now to track any kind of cattle genetics, parentage, lineage, etc. So we use actually the University of California at Davis.
That's my neck of the woods.
There
you
go.
Thank you very much.
Yes, that's right.
The California people do something.
You do a whole lot.
Thank you.
absolutely. So, no, we do DNA testing on our animals. It's able to, you know, track that DNA and the genetics of the animal and manage it accordingly to keep it diverse.
Okay, fantastic. Yeah, it's an amazingly powerful thing, and yet it's a little scary sometimes.
Yeah, no, like I said, they're wild animals, and, you know, that's why our handlers, we choose the handlers that we have here, because you need to know what you're doing. It's not just walking behind a Holstein down the alley here.
Yeah,
we've got to, you know, work with them and utilize their instincts to move them safely forward.
Yeah, and in terms of marketing, it's kind of an interesting thing because everybody else is very hands-on. Oh, go, especially in an event like this, it's easy to market the soft, cuddly thing.
Yeah,
we went to the Valley Blacknose booth, the Valley Blacknose Sheep Society, and they were mobbed, and everybody wants to hold the sheep, and that's a great, great thing for them to be able to market.
Yeah.
Can't really do that with this animal.
No, you can't.
But
no.
You do actually have the pride of the heritage and the history of this animal in North America. And so that, I guess that maybe makes up for it a little bit.
I think so. You know, we say that we are uniquely American in that all the animals that you see in production are in North America. We have zero imports of bison meat into the United States. We do work closely with Canada, we're so small, and again, for the betterment of the species. You know, bison don't know where the border is, and we don't want them to. So, you know, they've historically migrated from the Yukon Flats all the way to northern Mexico, and that's kind of the area that we focus on. So it's a really neat North American industry that really has no competition outside of our continent.
Yeah, and up there especially, I mean, we think that the 18 yesterday or 20 yeah. degrees or whatever it is now, 25 degrees. Right. It's tough here in Denver, but yeah. boy, up in Canada, they got quite a bit less than that. So I'm That's assuming right. this animal really is suited to that.
Yes, they are. Absolutely. So these animals do wonderful in the winter climates, and particularly in Canada. And, you know, it's interesting. Historically, again, they roamed all the way from Yukon Flats all the way to Mexico. And like a lot of other wildlife, they get smaller in stature as you go south, right? So there's yeah. there's Southern Plains bison, for example, in Texas and that neck of the woods. And as you go north, they kind of get larger. In Canada, there's a subspecies called the wood bison. And a wood bison is larger, darker coat, yeah. you know, and it's kind of a neat evolutionary thing.
I'm trying to remember, is that the ones that were in Banff and they were trying to reestablish up there?
In yep. Well, yes, I believe
those
are
wood
bison. And
the Tetons anyway, somewhere. I mean, not the Tetons, but the upper Rockies. That we think our Rockies are big here. Boy, right. up there they seem really big, don't
Absolutely.
They?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
You know, I think the Banff herd is actually plains bison, but there's also Wood Buffalo National Park up yeah. in Canada, and those are all woods bison. And they're quite similar. Again, the wood bison are just a little bit larger. And that's just evolution at work, you yeah. know, compared with the Southern Plains animals. And those types of animals do well in those regions accordingly. So we encourage local production and buying your breeding stock locally because they tend to do well there. But given their history of migrating across most of North America, yeah. they're also very diverse and can settle just about anywhere.
It's nice to remember that, isn't it? That even something that we see as just one animal is many different types and kinds and things. And
yes.
The things you can learn about all of these animals on the planet are just phenomenal, aren't
Absolutely.
They? We keep learning all the time. So.
Absolutely.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it. I know this yeah. is your big loadout, so this is
no
a kind
problem.
Of an exciting time, but boy, do I appreciate you talking.
Yeah, it's great to talk to you. I appreciate the opportunity.
Oh, now I need to give you a moment. If you have a website,
yes,
if
we do.
You could
yep.
list that, please.
Absolutely. BisonCentral.com is our website, and please come on, check out. We've got loads of information for producers looking into whether they want to raise animals on their operations, as well as consumers on how to cook it, where to find it, all the great health attributes for it. Come on by and check it out.
Fantastic. And do you have social media accounts as well?
We do, at National Bison. You can find us on all the social media platforms.
Fantastic. Thank you so much.
Yeah, it was great talking to you.
Okay, leave you to your loadout.
Well, thank you.
Sing some Jackson Browne.
If you liked our podcast, please subscribe. This is how we keep going. And please ask your friends to join us. Please also feel free to post any comments or questions to our social media sites. You can find us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook under Backyard Green Films. Thanks again for listening.
We'd like to thank Jim for joining us today. And if you'd like to find out more about these amazing animals, please visit BisonCentral.com. We'll see you next episode with another adventure. On our next episode, we speak with Dr. John Ewing and discuss life as a vet, so please join us. You have been listening to Agriculture with your host, Alara Bowman. Please tune in for upcoming episodes from our travels. I'm Rick Bowman, your behind-the-scenes editor. Until next time. This has been a presentation of Backyard Green Films Productions. All rights reserved. Copyright 2023.